Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new podcast from The Economist called Economics. Mix spelled M-I-X. Every 2 weeks, we'll be bringing you interesting stories from the world of economics and try and break them down to you as simply as you can. This is Tariq, joining you along with Jen.
Hey, guys.
So we, as part of Economist, believe that economics should be made as simple as possible because, Jen, we were at the Andy Zaltzman stand-up show last week.
Yes.
And Mr. Zaltzman made a very interesting observation. He said that, "I sincerely don't understand what economics is about, and I hope to die that way."
Yes, pretty much exact, to quote him.
We know that a lot of people feel the same way, but you really don't need to die wondering. Economics is a complex subject. It can at times get confusing, but it's also extremely fascinating. And as you will find out through some of the episodes of our podcast, that it's also extremely important. So that is why we are here, to break some of those myths down for you, to make it simpler for you. And most importantly, we encourage you to send us your queries, your questions, because we want exactly the kind of people who are like Andy Zaltzman, who will come to us and say, "You know what, we don't know anything about economics and we're hoping to die that way, but nonetheless, if you can explain this question to us." And we'll try our best. We are not experts, but we do have more than a passing interest in economics, Jayant.
Yes, of course.
So that is why we are here, to try and address those questions. So in our pilot episode of Economics, like Jayant was saying just before we pressed the record button, we are going with the low-hanging fruit. Early October is always an exciting time for us in economics, because that is the time when the economics Nobel Prize is given out, and we are always excited to know who that might be. You remember last year, Jayant?
Yes,
of
course. We were
super excited because it was Richard Thaler, a gentleman we had interviewed for this very podcast just months before the announcement was made. And while we strictly believe correlation is not causation,
yes, very much.
In this case, we were willing to make an exception because we kept telling people that Richard Thaler appeared on our podcast, and the next thing you know, he was a Nobel Prize winner. Coincidence? We think not. Anyway, this year's Nobel Prize winners have not yet appeared on our podcast.
Yes, they better be.
So this year's winners were William Nordhaus from Yale University and Paul Romer from New York University. They were awarded the prize, as the official announcement read, for Paul Romer for integrating technological innovations into long-run macroeconomic analysis, and Bill Nordhaus for integrating climate change into long-run macroeconomic analysis. And if that sounds a whole bunch of hodgepodge and Greek and Latin to you, that is exactly what we are here for, to explain what this award means and what was the work that these two economists were doing. Jayant, if you would want to get us started with a little bit of a backgrounder on what kind of work these two were doing.
The fascinating background about these two guys is both the winners, which is William and Paul Romer, have never collaborated with each other in the past. So what unites them in this work is they're studying how market economics sometimes fail to work as advertised. They focus on separate areas. They both examine the problem of market externalities or spillovers, which are key justification for taxes on energy, like gasoline or crude, or cap and trade schemes, research subsidies and other types of government intervention.
So essentially what they're working on is that generally most of neoclassical economics or free market-based economics suggests that demand and supply and the market will sort of take care of most economic problems. But there are times when the market doesn't work, like you were pointing out, and both Nordhaus and Romer actually study different aspects of these so-called market failures, which are caused because of this idea of externality or spillover, which is basically a cost or a benefit that affects people other than the main transacting parties. If again, externality sounds an alien concept to our listeners, not a problem. That's why we're here again. So somebody pointed to us out on Twitter recently saying that whenever these delivery guys are out for delivering things like Swiggy meals and from Zomato and people like that.
Food Panda.
And of course, Food Panda, which is now right in a part of the Ola app. By the way, we have no commercial affiliations with Ola.
Yeah.
They ride very rashly in traffic to try and sort of deliver the things on time. And while the incentive might be given to them by the company because they want to make sure customers get their food delivered hot and on time and things like that. So those two are the main parties to the transaction. But pedestrians, other cars, and traffic in general could be adversely affected because of their rash driving, which could be a problem. So that is what economists would call an externality, a third party getting affected by something they did not participate in. They did not pay for the food. They're not going to eat the food. They're not the ones who made it, but they're still getting affected. So it's basically bystanders getting affected. So this is an example of a negative externality. There could also be positive externality. For example, if somebody was holding a movie screening out in public and actually charged tickets for it, people who might be watching the movie after having bought a ticket, there might also be a lot of people who might be able to watch the movie without having bought a ticket. So those guys would be beneficiaries of what you would call a spillover, a positive kind of a spillover, because they're getting benefits which they have not really paid for, which is sort of a good thing. So, Jen, like you were saying, these two study specific kinds of externalities. So William Nordhaus has been studying the externality that is created by the climate, because the climate is part of the economy. Most other models would say that, okay, whatever the market is doing, based on the kind of benefits and costs that they will receive, they will do the right thing. So they say, okay, if a factory is polluting, or if somebody is cutting forests down or drilling the earth to take out fossil fuels, in the long run they should be okay, because if it's not sustainable or if it's costly, they will leave it out. But this is where the market fails, because it does not account for those costs and the
implicit cost, basically.
Yes. And the economy or the climate might be adversely affected, which could adversely affect the economy. So basically Nordhaus said that if you're studying economic growth and long-run economic growth, we should also study the climate itself, or the state of the climate itself, as one of the factors. Meanwhile, our friend Paul Romer was studying the effects of innovation. So whenever somebody innovate something, invent something new, how does it benefit the rest of the economy? And his argument was that innovation is not some external factor of economic growth. It is, in economics lingo, we'll call it an endogenous factor, that is part of the model of growth, which people benefit from. So, for example, the invention of a steam engine meant that there were so many new applications of the steam engine coming, which kind of helped the economy grow. In fact, Romer himself was sort of interested in studying this area because as Max Rosen, who's a researcher at the University of Oxford, a data visualizer, he shared a very interesting graph, and we'll share it on our blog if you want to take a look. which is like a hockey stick graph, where after remaining stagnant for very long, suddenly the per capita income or GDP in Great Britain exploded in the late 19th century and then the entire of the 20th century, almost in a straight line. And Romer looked at this and he was sort of fascinated by this idea that why should this happen? What has contributed to this? And that's how he got studying the idea of innovation as a factor.
The basic the chart goes back to 1270, so that's how the old the data is, and that's how the hockey stick. I mean, for almost till the 17th century, there wasn't that much of incremental growth in terms of per capita. Then it starts skyrocketing.
So you had a theory about why it skyrocketed. Would you want to talk about the theory on innovation?
So my basic question about the innovation is, up to what extent is the innovation rent-seeking? How good is innovation in the larger interest of the masses? Where do you draw a line with innovation and capitalism and making profit out of innovation?
Okay, so making profit out of innovation has been as old as capitalism itself. People have been saying that in the market you have to incentivize innovation, which means that if somebody comes up with something new, they want to be compensated for it. It's only fair because people are putting their own efforts, blood, sweat and tears to come up with something. James Watt came up with the steam engine, so naturally he would be expected to be compensated for it. But Jayanth, you were pointing out about how recent technologies have developed mostly from American defense research.
Yeah, so if you look at all the major innovation which has happened in terms of the whether it's internet or the gadgets, so many of the handheld devices thing, it's all developed basically at first at the defense of US, with Department of Defense in collaboration with various other associations like NASA and thing, developed the protocols or the first things from the scratch. That was for the greater good of the entire US citizens, which they never made money out of it. Of course, it was funded by the taxpayers' money, but now how do you pick that up from somewhere else, copy the technology and capitalism where the firm takes it into the next level and starts making money? Where do you draw the line in terms of that?
So that is the challenge that Romer's lifetime of research has been trying to address, and it's a great point that you bring out, which is the tension we also saw in the movie Social Network, if you remember. I mean, it was a fictionalized depiction of the tensions that went into the founding of Facebook. But a lot of the debate and discussion was about who owns what, whose idea is it, and can there be an ownership of an idea? There's a very heated moment in the movie when Jesse Eisenberg, playing Mark Zuckerberg, absolutely loses in the deposition.
That's correct. You had 42 days to study your system and get out ahead.
Do you see any of your code on Facebook?
Sorry, could Mark.
Did I use any of your code?
You stole our whole goddamn idea.
Fellas.
Match.com for Harvard.
Can I continue with my deposition?
You know, you really don't need a forensics team to get to the bottom of this. If you guys were the inventors of Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook.
One particular innovator might be putting a lot of their resources, money, etc., if they're a private innovator. And when they have invented something new, they would want control over it. So like you were saying, the idea of rent seeking is that they become a monopoly and they would want to charge monopoly prices, which is a price above the marginal cost of producing that item. Now the problem with most innovations is marginal cost of producing that item is very less, which means if you invent software, most of your cost is fixed cost. People have to hire to write the software, to invent it, and so on. Once you've invented it, it's just a question of copying it onto a pen drive or a computer. The cost of that is effectively zero. So Romer says that, you know, if you are looking at the sort of the market solution, ideally you could say the cost of innovation should actually be zero, the cost at which it should be distributed to everybody. It should ideally be completely free. However, the corporation would not agree, because in the case of the US Department of Defense, which was incidentally a major part, played a huge part in developing the internet. The first internet was developed at the Pentagon. But because it's a government entity, things came into public use and they did not charge separately for that. But a private enterprise would not give you things away because they have spent money to make it. So that is why they will charge a price which is higher than the marginal cost. A pharmaceutical company, if they manufacture a new drug, they would want a patent on it. Romer's study is mainly to try and figure out how strong should those patents be, because he feels that if you limit innovation too much, then we do not realize the full potential of economic growth that could be realized if the innovation was freely available to everybody. Which is why we have seen, for example, Google opening up its Android platform to everybody to try and grow their phone market or computing market is an example of how they're trying to reach out to everybody, but at the same time to try and retain some control, because Google is not a public entity. It's, after all, a company answerable to its shareholders. So far, the American government had invested billions and trillions of dollars into space research. But nowadays, it's not NASA who's at the forefront of space research. It is private companies, whether you talk about as Jeff Bezos
and Orange,
and the rockets he's launching.
Yeah.
Or, of course, you talk about our very own.
Our man, Elon Musk, SpaceX.
Elon Musk, SpaceX. So all of these are private billionaires who were funding these. And naturally, they're not going to do it for free. So the essential study that, or the essential thrust of Romer's arguments are that there should be some kind of government subsidies, etc., available, because the market will not strictly work here. If it's completely left to the market, there might be too much of monopoly power and too much of potential rent seeking eventually, because firms will want protection. At the same time, you cannot make it completely open. So he says that maybe the governments could help by subsidizing some of these innovations. The governments could incentivize innovation by giving those subsidies, as well as giving some amount of protection in terms of patents, which is why when new drugs come out, the companies are given a certain amount of time for which they can sell it exclusively before they become available to the general public. The formula itself becomes generic.
Generic.
So what do you call generic drugs? So those are the tensions that he's trying to deal with. Incidentally, innovation is also crucial for solving most of our toughest economic problems.
Which is?
And one of the toughest economic problems we are facing right now is, of course, climate change.
Well, what's that?
So I'm guessing you're quoting Donald Trump here?
No prize for guessing that.
So climate change has been a major issue. Just recently, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, came out with its latest report, a special report in which it warns that we only have just about a decade's worth of time left to do something about reducing greenhouse gas emission, which will halt the rise in temperature across the globe to an average of 1.5 degrees centigrade or less, because they say if it goes beyond that, then you cannot reverse the problems caused by climate change. So they're saying there is only like a decade left to work on it, and by 2040 we might be starting to feel the effects of it very badly, and for all purposes practical, doomsday might arrive, like it did in the movie The Day After Tomorrow.
Okay.
Exaggerated movie, but it had a good point. So talk us through about what world leaders are thinking on climate change, Jayanth.
So the problem with climate change is it only comes up when such report comes in, a serious discussion happens, or when some calamities happen, we only discuss in boardrooms and or a cup of tea, and then we just forget it when everything is going well, because most of our guys who lead us are very much don't keep up the end of the bargain when it comes to actual implementation, which is cutting the greenhouse emission, especially the developed nations. The current leader of the current regime in the US doesn't believe in climate change, I suppose. What does he call that?
He calls it, well, a hoax devised by China. He has completely, so every time there is even the slightest of low temperatures in New York or Washington, D.C., he will say, well, we could use some global warming now, which clearly shows that he understands very little of any of the science.
And back home here, it's even more paradoxical. Our own leader, Modiji, says climate has not changed. We have changed and our tolerance and habits have changed. So that's on the other end of the spectrum.
That is clearly our PM talking on behalf of the entire electorate, which for some reason is 65 years old.
Yeah.
In terms of the
tolerance. And on the other end, his contribution to having solar plants, having natural energy, neat energy, we are one of the largest guys who are setting up such capacities. He goes on and wins award or shares it with the France Macron, the award which recently was given by United Nations Secretary General for the contribution towards solar neat energy. So at one end we are receiving awards for neat energy, on the other end we are just denying that there isn't any climate change, and this just, we are scratching the surface. As you go down the spectrum of the other nation leaders, it only gets worse. I mean, so this is the 2 cents take on the climate change and the leaders.
Okay, so let's try and break this down, that climate change has been a problem for a long time because William Nordhaus has spent an entire lifetime studying it. He started studying it in the early 70s when he heard about fossil fuels and how they are contributing to increase in greenhouse gas emissions, which are sort of getting trapped in the atmosphere, and because of that, or rather, which increasing in the atmosphere are leading to more heat being trapped within the atmosphere, which is leading to the so-called global warming, which can have various effects from melting the polar ice caps to raising temperatures across countries across the world to rising sea levels, which could make entire countries disappear. The whole of the islands of Hawaii could go, for example. Or there could be effects such as extreme climate conditions, which could make life difficult. There could be more hurricanes, there could be more tornadoes, there could be more floods. We saw problems with floods this year. In fact, the Kerala flood was entirely an environmental issue and a man-made issue, because a lot of it had to do with deforestation and the building of dams and things like that. So Romer has, Nordhaus has spent a lifetime studying that, and he made the environment a part of the economic growth model. So again, like we were discussing earlier, they come from this angle of studying economic growth and saying, what are the factors that cause an economy to grow? In Nordhaus's opinion, the environment is one of the factors, and it could create an additional constraint if the environment is not being taken care of, which means that infinitely long periods of time of growth cannot continue because we'll hit a natural wall.
With finite resources and growth at what cost is basically what is trying to solve.
So one of the things that has been pointed out both by his research and otherwise is that a lot of the pollution and all that we talk about come from very concentrated sources. Like you said, the developed nations actually contribute to a majority of the pollution or the greenhouse gases across the world. The top 100 corporations, the fossil fuel companies, the petroleum companies, essentially contribute to about 70% of those pollution for the past 30 odd years. So all this means that the problem lies in the fact that these particular corporations or firms are getting away with doing something for which there are no consequences or cost. The problem of externality here.
Basically, someone else is paying the cost for the profits they're making.
Exactly. So, and those someone else, unfortunately, are overwhelmingly living in developing countries where they're getting affected by pollution, these extreme weather conditions, and so on. So, what Nordhaus is suggesting is that there needs to be government intervention here to try and stop these guys, or at least make them accountable for the kind of cost they're imposing on the environment. The problem is that politically, there does not seem to be a lot of will about it. Donald Trump, for example, has supported coal for a long time. He has promised jobs in coal mines. So they've gone ahead and struck off regulations which were imposed to try and reduce the consumption or dependence on these kind of fuels. And they were wanting to divert to more cleaner fuels, like you mentioned, Narendra Modi's award along with Emmanuel Macron for development of cleaner sources of energy.
So this is exactly the paradox what I was telling about. These are the developed nations who have abused the environment for so many years. And check out the paradox. They are going back to coal, and at the other end of the bargain wherein we at their scale have never reached those kinds of abuse of greenhouse, and we are creating so many of neat and clean energy using solar. What stops US from doing that? It's so paradox at so many levels.
So the funny thing is, what stops it there is people looking at short-term gains and political gains, essentially. So these are constituencies of coal workers and coal miners that they have to serve. So that is why they're willing to lie to them saying there is no climate change. They're willing to lie to them saying there's something called clean coal. Nobody really understands what clean coal is.
So what's that?
Except the fact that Donald Trump keeps repeating that point. And of course, because of that, the kind of solutions that Nordhaus suggested, which is like a kind of a carbon tax that the heaviest polluters also have to pay extra because of their cost of pollution, and imposing carbon caps or emission caps, saying that you cannot go beyond a certain level of emissions in the coming future, which was what everybody signed under the Paris Climate Accords to try and limit the greenhouse gas emissions to current levels, or put them back to current levels by the year 2100. The US has actually withdrawn from that agreement.
Yes.
In Brazil, another country dealing with huge environmental issues, including deforestation, the
major
the
commodity exporting country.
Nation. The current projected presidential candidate has said that if he comes to power, he's also going to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. So this is the problem. The tension here is that Nordhaus's lifetime of research suggested that to protect the environment, the economy cannot be left to its own supply and demand devices because of these negative externalities like pollution, which create effects for other people, but not necessarily for the corporations who are actually doing it. So to prevent that from happening, those corporations need to be made to pay the price. But because of these political actions, that actually may never happen. People may not switch over to electric cars. Elon Musk will be unhappy.
Yeah.
People may not completely abandon fossil fuels. So that's where we are heading in the world, in a fascinating place now, where on one side, one of the Nobel laureates' work, that is Paul Romer's work, is talking about how innovation can solve a lot of these problems. But greedy corporations are trying to keep on holding on to that monopoly power that they can get through certain innovations by not letting others copy them or buying them off. Facebook, for example, started as an independent company, but now with so much power, it's buying off its competitors. It bought WhatsApp, it bought Instagram. There is nothing that is not Facebook. Or on the other side, there is Google, a company started as Don't Be Evil, open source and things like that. We said at the start of the podcast how good a thing that was. But now they seem like they again own everything, and they are trying to restrict other people from using it, which kind of can slow down innovation, which is what Paul Romer worries about. He says that is the issue. So he sort of cites the Microsoft case from the mid-90s or late 90s when there was a case against Microsoft in the Justice Department in the US where Bill Gates had to go and testify.
Yes.
And during that judgment...
Was this during the Bill Clinton regime?
This was during the Bill Clinton regime. Well, and eventually Gates would not be the only Bill to testify during that regime. Although on a very different issue. So Romer cites Microsoft as one of the cases, and he says, in the case of Microsoft, the issue that they wanted to establish was that whether by doing the things that it was doing, which is forcing people to use its products, was it stifling or stopping other innovation from happening? Because that is what can then slow down the economy or the possibilities for the economy. And now more than ever, we need newer ideas and newer things that work because we need to stop these issues of climate change, and we need innovations fast to try and stop them.
So here, basically, I would like to plug in basic reading which I did a few years before, which is Elon Musk's good friend Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1, so wherein he speaks about horizontal innovation and vertical innovation. So wherein he says that, so whatever the globalization is all about horizontal, which is basically whichever nation comes out with the innovation, the other nation, smaller, less developed nation, just cut, copy, paste that into economics, which the Chinese have been doing that very successfully for the past 30 years in terms of copying all the innovation out of the US and just replicating the growth and the thing. But the greater extent of what has that happened is hazardous for the environment, wherein we can't keep burning so much of greenhouse emission to have of growth.
And so, for example, if China copies the kind of cars that the US or Europe makes, and if they continue to make them for the millions of their consumers, well, that's not the optimal solution. So we're not letting innovation happen. Yes.
So Peter Thiel says that's going from 1 to 10. So basically copying and doing it at larger scale and just going on with the things. So then he talks about vertical innovation, which is basically going from 0 to 1. Totally new thing wherein you innovate in such a way that you bring in new concepts, solve new energy, bring in new energy which solves your energy crisis, when it's clean tech kind of technology which takes it, and wherein you don't have that much of environmental problems, that way you can actually solve. So this horizontal versus vertical things draws us more nearer to the guys what won the Nobel, wherein coming out with new tech versus climate change. And this is the reference which I wanted to quote from the book 0 to 1.
And an excellent point about 0 to 1, that this is basically that famous quote that some people look at things or something new and say why, and I look at something new and say why not. So 0 to 1 is sort of the second kind of scenario. In fact, incidentally, both our Nobel Prize winning economists started off from the same pedestal, which was Robert Solow's, another Nobel Prize winner.
Yes.
Robert Solow's growth theory, which said that economic growth happens because of increasing productivity of capital and better ways to put capital together and so on. So going into the long run, all countries will achieve sort of similar rates of growth because, like you said, countries cut, copy, paste ideas from each other. But that's where these two guys challenged it in different ways, where Romer said, no, it does not need to be cut, copy, paste. Innovation can be a part of the economic environment, and free innovation can lead to much higher rates of economic growth than what Solow's model really predicts. And William Nordhaus, of course, came and said that Solow's model ignores the impact on the environment and then the environment's impact on the economy. And he says that we cannot ignore that because we are effectively living in the environment. So we need that to be included in our economic analysis too. And now we are in this interesting moment in history where both of these things have kind of actually converged, because the two biggest questions to answer in the coming 10 or 20 years would be, number one, can we solve the climate problem? And if we have to solve it,
what kind of innovations
would you be needing? And should those innovations be open to everybody? Because climate change is a problem that affects every single person on the planet. So like the president says in The Day After Tomorrow, save as many as you can.
If we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
I'm afraid that time has come and gone, my friend.
What can we do?
Save as many as you can.
All right, that brings us to the end of the discussion. Hopefully, you listeners found it interesting and illuminating in terms of understanding what this year's Nobel Prize was about. If you have any questions, you can always ask us. You can get back to us. We'll be happy to carry forward discussions because that's what we are about here at The Economist. We want you to express your curiosity to us. You can follow us on Twitter at The Economist. So there is an R in between, ECONORMIST. Don't follow the Economist, or maybe you already follow them, but add the R and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to our podcast on Pocket Casts, on iTunes, on Google Podcast, any of the podcatching platforms that you may be using, or you can visit our own channel on Audioboom. It's audioboom.com/channel/economist. You can find our previous episodes there, and of course this one and future episodes of Economics from the Economist podcast will be coming to you every 2 weeks. You can follow our blog at itsthemarket.wordpress.com. That's where we put up a lot of our blogs. We'll be putting out some of the graphs, etc., we talked about in this podcast there as well for your reference. And you can follow Jane on
Jayz30.
So that's not J-A-Y-Z, that's J-A-I-Z30,
yeah,
on Twitter. And you can follow me at Tariq Laskar, T-A-R-I-Q-U-E-L-A-S-K-A-R. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope to have you around next time when we will dive into another nook and cranny of this economics highway and bring you another episode of Economics. Economics with an X.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.